Hey there, welcome to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I'm your host, John Spencer. I'm a former middle school teacher, I'm a current college professor, and I am passionate about seeing teachers transform their classrooms into bastions of creativity and wonder. And so on this podcast, we share ideas and strategies and blueprints. I tell stories, I talk about my big epic fails, and I talk about experts, because I am on this journey as well of trying to make my classroom more creative. And one of the areas that I love to talk about and to share ideas from is project-based learning. And so I am super excited to share with you an interview I did last week with two true PBL experts. When I say experts, I mean they know the theory of PBL, they know the research of PBL, but they also have decades of lived experience as educators doing project-based learning. And what they're going to talk about is this overlap of PBL and SEL. And they are the co-authors of the new book, Pulse of PBL, Cultivating Equity Through Social Emotional Learning. And a quick disclosure, my wife and I run and own Blend Education, the publishing platform that is publishing this book. And we are so excited to have this book out. It just released yesterday. It's already got 1 5-star review. I mean, it is a phenomenal book. It's practical. It has great stories in it. It's a big idea book, but it's also something that is manageable and doable. And one of the things that I think about is just this idea of that overlap of SEL and PBL being so vital, because when great project-based learning happens, great social-emotional skills are developed. People can call them soft skills, essential skills, people skills, whatever skills you want to call them. But the truth is, those are great SEL skills. And at the same time, when we incorporate great SEL into project-based learning, it becomes more authentic, and we take the PBL to the next level. Before we get started, let me tell you briefly a little bit about them. Mike Cackley is a teacher who leads project-based learning and social-emotional learning workshops around the country, helping educators make the shift to student-centered inquiry. He earned national exposure as an avid blogger and has been featured in Edutopia, PBL Works, EdWeek, New Tech Network, We Grow Teachers, and Teach Thought. He is National Faculty Emeritus with PBL Works, which used to be the Buck Institute of Education. During his 20-year career, he has integrated projects across all 4 content areas and electives in both middle school and high school. He is a phenomenal teacher. He's actually someone who I have gotten to watch teach project-based learning, and it is amazing. Now, how about Dr. Matinga Rugatz? Matinga is a multiple award-winning educator, author, keynote speaker, and consultant. As an innovative educator, she redefined learning and developed a trusted voice, striving to revolutionize the way children learn and the way teachers teach. Among many accolades, she served as Michigan Teacher of the Year in 2017 and was inducted in the National Teacher Hall of Fame. She holds a PhD in education with a specialty in learning, instruction, and innovation, and is national faculty at PBL Works Buck Institute in Education. Matinga's international background and her own challenging learning experience inspire a unique perspective on the cultivation of students' talents and abilities. In 2017, she opened a PBL food science school in Tanzania, focusing on children of extreme poverty and their learning needs. I'm telling you, she is an amazing educator, and so is Mike Cackley, and I am so excited that we are publishing the book, Pulse of PBL, and that I got the chance to interview them. So without further ado, here is the interview. All right, we have with us here Matinga and Mike, and I am so excited to have you both as guests. As I mentioned, I am really excited about their book that's coming out, and getting to be a part of them, a part of their process has been a lot of fun. I would love for you to both start out with your PBL journey. So let's start with Matinga. How did you get into PBL?
First of all, thank you for having us. We are both really excited to talk about our book. I mean, what else can we do but talk about this book, right? Yes. And so my personal journey is, you know, I use PBL as a crutch You will notice as I speak that I do have a world accent. This is what I call it. But when I first started teaching like 20 some years ago, it was bad. And I mispronounced things all the time. So as a high school teacher, students made fun of me all day, every day. And so I had to figure out ways to get out of the front of the classroom because I was like, no, I can't even pronounce that. That's not going to happen. And so that's how I started just kind of looking for ways to not be the orator in the front. And I remember it was like about year five when I ran into a workbook from Buck Institute that was like, wait, this is already what I'm doing, except it's got a name. So that's my journey. And since then, it really changed the way that I looked at my classroom, what my students did. I was a very strict teacher to start with. And so loosened me up and it just kind of taught me how to love my job again.
I love it. You know, I love that aspect that you said of sort of like what felt like a constraint or a challenge ended up being the very strengths that allowed you to be a more authentic teacher, right? So feeling nervous about your voice, unsure about it, but that becomes the very thing that makes you better at your craft, right? Which is
and
pretty-
that made the students be more engaged. I mean, I have a very melodious voice, as you could hear, but my students didn't necessarily think so. So having them become the stars of the show, to put it a certain way, just made it so that they were more engaged, and I was able to get out of their way a lot easier.
I love it. How about you, Mike? What's your PBL journey?
Yeah, I think from the beginning, one of my mottos was whoever is doing is learning. And so I always wanted to be student focused. And much like Matenga, I didn't have any training. I didn't know what I was doing with it. But my second year teaching, I ended up at a middle school teaching what would be called STEM today. It wasn't called that back then. And so I was doing all these hands-on kind of projects, but I was integrating all the curriculum into it. And I was really enjoying it, having fun with it, didn't know what it was, but basically was doing PBL. And then I really wanted to move out of the elective classroom into a core classroom. And New Tech Network, which is a PBL network of schools all across the country, started a brand new school in my county, and it was going to be a lab school. And so on a whim, I applied, not thinking I had a chance, ended up being one of the original teachers there. And then I was professionally trained in PBL by multiple different places. And that's kind of where I really dove deep into it. And it matched, you know, the pedagogy that I believed in of kids doing, me coaching.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I love about this, and this was the case when I had Trevor Muir on the show as well, I've gotten to see you teach, Mike. So, you know, sometimes when it comes down to like, you know, how much do you really know about the classroom practices of someone who's on the podcast? I can say like, you're the real deal. You do project-based learning really, really well. And I've gotten a chance to witness that firsthand, which I think is part of why I was excited about your book when you first shared the concept of it. You know, one of the things I'm struck by in hearing both of your stories was you discovered PBL, but you also discovered you had been doing PBL before discovering PBL, right? And one of the things I see sometimes is when people first hear about project-based learning, there's kind of two directions you can go when you feel like you've been doing it before. You can go the dismissive route of, oh, I'm already doing it. There's nothing to learn here. I've been doing this for years. Why am I learning this new thing, PBL? Why do you got to call it that? Or you can say, okay, wait, there's a name and a term and a framework for what I'm already doing. I found my home in pedagogy, or I found my thing. What do you think it was about both of you, mindset-wise or attitude-wise, that caused you to say, I want to learn more rather than I'm already doing it, I'm good?
Good question. And for me, you know, I teach by instinct. It's not always a safe thing to do, but I'm very instinctual. I'm very curious, and I am very self-conscious about serving stale stuff. So even in my history class or my social studies classes or my global studies courses, I just felt like I couldn't teach the same lesson the same way each year. I just couldn't. I would have different themes. Oh, this year we're doing revolution. Next year we're doing, I don't know, war. We just had the whole code the whole year with a different theme. And that was just my own style, is also my own personality, where I get bored easily. And so for me to just kind of follow my instinct, and a lot of the educators that are listening will feel the same way, where you have an instinct, you know where you want to go. And before you know it, you are there. You look back and going, wow, I am doing things really, really differently. I didn't set out to be different, because it's really hard. It's really difficult to translate, say, a learning circle, which is a Native American concept, to teach students discussion. I called it circle day back in the day. I got in a lot of trouble because my administrators and my colleagues thought I was stepping outside of the social studies realm, where really I was using a Native American concept to teach the children how to speak and discuss and have this kind of grow a community. So it was really hard for me to put that into words. But as I started recognizing that it was project-based learning that gave me the vocabulary and the confidence to be like, yeah, no, this is research, then it goes back many, many years. And really, not to like highlight PBL so much, but it is like a really organic way of learning. If you go back to Maria Montessori, if you go back to the medieval ages, the idea that a child goes by interests and they just become a master, they master the material, and that's how they go forth. It's just such a organic and such a personal journey for the students. So yeah, not for me, it was not on purpose, but it was a happy accident.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah. How about you, Mike? Yeah,
I think for me, I mean, I didn't have any classes that taught me about PBL in my school of ed. You know, I think that's shifting now, but back then there really was nothing. And as I said, I had this, we had to write our philosophy of education, all that. And to me, mine was summarized in whoever's doing is learning. And I just wanted to be hands-on. And when I saw PBL, it just matched my belief system. And it's cliche, but I'm a lifelong learner. And so I'm always looking to improve my craft. I've never arrived. And so PBL just gave me more tools and structures to do what I was already trying to do in a better way.
Yeah. So both of you embraced PBL fairly early on as educators. For you, Matinga, it sounds like it's a little more of an evolution, right? From being more hyper-structured to being more, I guess, open and organic. For you, Mike, it's a little bit closer to what you had always kind of believed in. And I'm curious, what were some of the challenges that you both faced in implementing PBL?
Mike, you go ahead, because you started as school, like you basically were the...
When I started at my school, wall-to-wall PBL all the time, I was so excited. I mean, I was pumped out of my mind. And so I started my first project off, and it's like student voice and choice. That's the other thing I was huge on, student voice and choice. I'm going to give the kids all kinds of choices. We're going to do this wide open project. Mm-hmm. And so I'm teaching this group of freshmen, and it's a combined social studies English class. And we start our first project, and we start going through it. And all of a sudden, the students start coming to me begging for structure. And what I had to learn is, just because I wanted to have student voice and choice and have this wide open, the kids weren't ready for it yet. They'd been in school for 9 years in a very teacher tell them what to do. They do what they're told. And my highest achieving students were the ones that were freaking out because they weren't sure they're going to get an A and they didn't know what they were doing. And so I learned I had to pull back and add some structure and create some structure, and that we couldn't just go wide open from the get-go, but that I had to actually gradually release them into student voice choice. So they needed.
I love that purpose. Gradual release. Yeah. I mean, because it's so interesting. That resonates so much for me because, you know, my first project I did with students was too structured, right? And it was a documentary project, and it worked really well. Kids loved it. And I said, all right, I'm going to jump. We're going to do something way more authentic. And so I do this other project, and they're sort of independent projects, and students are designing their own. They're working in teams of three or four. And it was about 3 days into it before I realized literally nobody knew what they were doing. Like, there was no roadmap. There was no blueprint. There was nothing for them. And then I began to see it, you know, and I was like, all right, structure is not a bad thing. Structure is a good thing. If it's empowering people, if it's allowing them to have that voice and choice. And then I found at the end of my first year that students, things were running on its own, right? They knew what to do. It was like seamless. Things are going well. And then I jump in at the beginning of the next year and I forget a new group of students they don't know what to do with the same level of autonomy. Like there has to be this gradual release piece. And so I'm curious, when you talk about gradual release, what have been some of the things both of you have used to sort of give students that gradual release where they can have more and more autonomy as the year progresses? Like, what does that look like?
I'll take this. I'll start with this one, Mike, if you don't mind. Yeah. And, you know, for me, because my trajectory was very much of an evolution, it was almost like you were going into a journey. And then as you were in the journey, you pick up the pieces that you need. And so I was watching my kids play video games. Mm-hmm. And I would be looking over their shoulder, which they didn't like at all whatsoever. But I was always marveled at how, you know, a child that is not necessarily very extroverted, that does not really exemplify like leadership material. But when they are in the video game, they don't turn around and ask me for help ever. They are so what? And a child that's an introvert is all of a sudden leading legions of armies and screaming into the mic and completely flank this and then that and doing these things that they cannot do in my classroom. And for me, I was like, how can I get that epic win type of atmosphere into my classroom? But I understand if you're watching these kids play video game, they're able to fail and fail and fail again. And remember when the whole Angry Birds trajectory thing was really big. But it's really true. And for me, I started understanding there was a culture to the learning, right? Mm-hmm. It was not just that you get to do it again, but there was a specific culture. Even when you meet with some characters, how do you know you're supposed to talk to that character? When I look at you talking to that character, it makes no sense to me. But the child understood how to talk to that character, where to go to that cave, how to use this hand gadget to make their characters jump and whatnot, right? And so that to me translated into, I just need to teach you all of these parts. And so for me to create that, okay, let's all work together for something and to ensure that every child that was coming in every year understood the rules of the game, we had to start with the rules. So this is when I created that student orientation that's highlighted in the book, where I'm going to orient you, or at least teach you, or at least train you, right? As if I am going to walk away and there's an expectation that you're going to continue to work like you would with a fast food worker or any kind of employee orientation. And to me, that's where my whole pedagogy shifted from me trying to teach them and being frustrated that they don't understand what I'm trying to, they're not picking up what I'm putting down, right? To I wasn't picking up what they're putting down because I was in their way. Does that make sense? Because they understood, listen, this is how I talk here. This is how I discuss. This is how I reflect. This is what she means by effort, et cetera, et cetera.
And one of the things I'm struck by in this is you're kind of alluding to it already. You know, your new book focuses on this overlap of project-based learning and social-emotional learning. And for people who are unfamiliar with the term social and emotional learning, what is it and why is it important?
Well, there's I guess, lots of different versions of social emotional learning. But what I tend to describe it that I think makes the most sense to a lot of people is the term soft skills. If you look at most things that are called soft skills, they're social emotional learning. And I hate the term soft skills because it makes them sound weak. And you lose a job and get fired over them, it's definitely not feeling too soft. So we use the CASEL competency because it's one of the most well-known ones. And it has five broad categories. And they are self-awareness, self-management, responsible decision-making, relationship skills, and social awareness. And they kind of categorize all these kind of characteristics that most any educator would say, I want my students to have these skills. And they tend to be seen as outside of academic, pure academic skills. But in reality, they're interwoven when you really understand what they are. They're not separate. In CASEL, I mean, it stands for academic is what the A is in CASEL. So we don't want to separate the two.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if I may add to that a little bit as well, just piggyback on what Mike said, you know, SEL is that pulse, and we'll talk a bit about it a little bit later, I'm sure. But that is what really, like, if a child understands, like, if he or she or they is self-aware, they can self-manage better. And if they can self-manage, they can be more socially aware. And if they're more socially aware, they can build better relationships and make better decisions and responsible decisions. And Mike and I believe that this is like the highlight. This is how you create equity, not by learning all the different cultures and understanding how to, you know, code switch every time a student from a different country comes in. It's not that, or putting a curriculum for Black kids or for Latino kids, or is this Asian American? None of that. We feel like if you can teach or train your students to have that self-awareness with the idea that you can have, you can train a person to make better decisions, weaving it into your academic curriculum, you're really expanding their opportunity for them to find their own equity. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. I want to stay on that topic for just a moment, the equity piece. You know, one of the things I loved in your book is how you sort of redefine SEL beyond an individual student's ability to sort of self-manage, which I think is a lot of what people kind of imagine SEL is. And you bring in this equity lens, this justice lens, this other lens that is not what automatically comes to mind for a lot of folks when they hear the word SEL. And I'm wondering if you could speak to that a little bit. Where do you see SEL being in terms of, you know, you alluded to it in terms of it promotes equity, but how do you see equity and even justice tying into the idea of social emotional learning?
Good question. Equity for us is just the main ingredient. And this is Mike's quote. Equity is the main ingredient. You don't go looking to equity as if, oh, wait, I forgot. I need to put equity in here. And then in the book, we talk about equity, like exchanging the name, the word equity with like Black people or Asian people. So when you have an equity curriculum or equity initiative, it's like, let's have a Black people initiative. Let's have a Asian American and a Native Hawaiian equity, a curriculum. So it just really is a fine line between inclusion, equity and othering people. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that we believe SEL can do is not just teach the student that self-management with the yoga and the breathing, but also transform the way that students see themselves as a learner. And that is what we believe becomes equity. The student should be able to find their own path rather than me thinking that I can create a path from a student that doesn't have the same lived experiences that I do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I would just add to that, we define SEL as three types. And the first type is individual. And that's where a lot of teachers, and I mean, I shouldn't say teachers. I think a lot of SEL programs, if you buy the canned curriculum, is where it lands and where it stays. And that's all well and good. We're not saying that there's anything wrong with that. But we believe there's two other levels that build on top of it that are higher levels. And the second level is collaborative. And this is where you go beyond these skills for your own self, but you mm-hmm. learn how to use these skills to work together with others. And equity is definitely a piece of that, because we want students with working with all kinds of people, including the community, not just other students, but the community. And then the third level is transformative SEL. And this is where SEL is not just working for yourself, not just working with others, but actually doing something to change the world and make it a better place. And that's where it ties into PBL, and that we want kids doing projects that are going to change the world. And they can take on huge global issues like poverty or climate change or, you know, gun violence, whatever, at a local level. So they're not going to solve worldwide poverty, but they can say, you know, what does poverty look like in our community and what can we do about it here? And so they can transform themselves by doing meaningful work in their local community on really important issues.
I love it. And, you know, one of the things I was struck by in your book with the equity piece and just the transformative SEL is it's sort of the opposite of tokenism, right? It's not, oh, hey, you know, I'm a former social studies teacher. That's where I started out, where I was like, suddenly the whole school says, oh, it's this month. Oh, it's that month. You know, and it's the opposite of that. It's saying, no, this is everything. This is going to transform everything. And so if someone is unsure about this book, if you're someone who's maybe done some project-based learning, but you're thinking, well, maybe SEL has a place, or you've done some SEL and you're thinking, it didn't really work. We did these mini lessons and they weren't connecting. One of the things that you really get into is the transformative aspect is not just transforming the world and the projects, but you get into every aspect of the class. And that's one of the things I loved was classroom expectations and things around everything from, you know, examining your biases around volume level and expectation or classroom management or who, you know, allowing students, empowering students to be a part of the planning process. And you bring in, you know, the transformative piece really is bigger than just PBL. It's transforming your whole teaching practice, which I loved that piece because you were willing to reimagine it bigger even than I think just SEL or just PBL.
Right. And when you're talking equity, especially, you know, and you add it to SEL, as an educator, you're teaching or you're training your students in these SEL practices. And our book is full of these different strategies and approaches that are tried and true that Mike and I have tried it in our classrooms. But the really interesting thing about how we translate equity is that you're transforming the individual so that the individual can feel like they can do the work, that they fit in, and they have a reason to be in your classroom, right? Mm-hmm. Because as a teacher, there's no way I can be like Google and understand what every or Alexa and listen to what everything that the students want and they need. So for us, it was a shortcut by putting the onus on creating real equity on the student, but we teach them how to get there, right?
You know, one of the things that I'm thinking about as you share this is, and you've alluded to it a little bit when you talk about the CAN curriculum, but there are a lot of misconceptions that people have about social emotional learning. And I'm wondering if you could speak to what are some of the misconceptions or myths that folks hold regarding SEL?
Mike, you got this one.
All right, I'll share one or two. One of the things, especially from secondary teachers, is they think it's all just a bunch of fluff. Like, mm-hmm. I got to teach my content. I don't have time for this. Kumbaya around the campfire, you know, tell a story, throw your stick in. And some of that comes from the focus on yoga and breathing exercises and some of these skills. And what we would say is that's a piece of equity. And those are tools. Those aren't the CASEL competencies, the SEL competencies themselves. And so I can't be responsible decision-making about breathing. That's not going to help me make a good choice there. So breathing is a good tool for some situations, but not all situations. And so we believe that PBL is a framework, a structure that lets us practice all the competencies. And so instead of being fluff, it's actually key, and there's plenty of research out there that shows that when you develop these skills, you're more academically successful. Because if you can problem solve, that's going to help you in math and science class. If you can communicate better, That's going to help you in your writing and speaking in English class. So they're not separate from content, but they're key skills that actually help you be more successful in your content area.
You know, for people that are kind of hearing this and they're going, all right, I'm starting to see the main point here. I loved in the book kind of two secondary areas where people might say, not sure SEL fits my content area, right? You know, that sort of attitude. And one of them was sort of the humanities area, especially, you know, if someone's an English teacher and they're going, look, we have novels that we're studying, a history teacher, we have history that we have to teach. There's content, we're heavy duty content. And I was just struck by the way that you used the novel Ender's Game and how that project developed everything from self-awareness through responsible decision-making through, you know, how you're actually interacting with the world, while really in that process, you learn the novel at a deeper level. I guarantee no student is leaving that classroom with a lower understanding of a novel. They have a deeper understanding, right? And so I think that that's a part of it, is like you're actually raising the academic standards higher, or the opposite, you know, in a different domain. So if that's humanities, thinking about the water project, both of those, one more in the STEM side, one more in the humanities side, they're leading to deeper academic knowledge, not shallower, not taking time away to go do yoga, like you said. It's learning it at a deeper level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And why do you read a piece of literature? Any English teacher is looking at the themes, right? Well, the themes are going to tie into SEL most of the time. You can find an SEL theme, and that's probably why you're reading that literature. And so you take that theme of Ender's Game, of what is good intentions, what matters more, good intentions, or what you actually do, and you tie that into the SEL theme. And so that's why we read literature.
Mm-hmm. So that's one myth, would be it's not academic. Any other myths or misconceptions?
Yeah, I like the you know, like SEL is going to save my students of color, right? What we often see, especially in schools where there's mostly brown and black children, and there is a lot of this SEL, just sort of justice, and a lot of this stuff, because it's looked at as a classroom management tool, when really you're just othering those kids by saying, oh, the other kids in the suburbs get to do enrichment classes and frolic through the poppies while everybody else gets to learn how to breathe, right? And so in those environments, I feel like, you know, again, it's not what SEL, it's misused SEL. Like, again, it's just staying in that level one, you know, work on yourself level, rather than the impact. Like, what are the ripples that you're going to make through life because you know the knowledge that we are discussing in class?
Yeah, it seems like it's not only misused, it's almost weaponized, right? It's almost, you know, which is even worse than a misuse, right?
It's a bucket, and it's a bucket list type thing. Oh, we do SEL in our school. Of course, we also do restorative justice. Yeah, we do yoga. Yeah, so it's almost become a checklist. Let's buy this canned curriculum. And that's another one of the myths, whether these canned curriculums written by people who don't know the kids in your community, and somehow this is going to transform the students' learning. So for us, Mike and I, we felt like instead of a canned curriculum, or instead of, okay, let's target our certain kids, it's like, you know, what are the things that the kids are not getting? Okay, let's make a list of those things and turn them into lessons, life lessons, and then weave them into their academic lessons.
I love it. So we kind of got into, you know, your PBL journey, the why PBL aspect, right? And then also the SEL, the misconceptions. I'd love to bring this together now for a moment and just think about why the overlap. So I'm going to ask these two questions separately. The first question would be, how does PBL make SEL better? So why is the overlap going to make for deeper social and emotional learning compared to the separate lessons or the canned curriculum or whatever for SEL? Mm.
Well, I really think it starts with what Matinga just said, and this is what most schools are doing, if we're honest. They're buying a canned curriculum. They're doing it in their morning meeting in elementary school, or they're doing it in an advisory class in secondary. And it becomes this little part of the day, and it's separated. And all the research tells us that SEL needs to be integrated, modeled by the adult, and throughout the day. And that is why how PBL makes it better, because if you're just going to be a traditional teacher who stands in front and teaches, there's no opportunity for students to learn and practice these skills. We know our students are experts in all these skills. No one is. No human is. I'm still working on SEL skills. And so PBL gives kids real life practice of all these skills every single day. They can work on making decisions. They can work on collaborating. And they can't do that if they're just sitting and listening to the teacher all day long. They have to have the opportunity to practice, make mistakes, and learn. Mm-hmm.
It almost feels like, imagine if they said, we need art. And so we're going to do 15 minutes of telling you what art is every morning. Or we need music, so we're going to tell you what music is for 15 minutes every morning. Or, hey, we realize kids need to be active and they're really into sports and there's some great benefits from doing sports. But instead of creating, team sport experiences and practicing the skills of sports, you're going to sit down and hear someone tell you, and we're going to have a little circle time conversation about sports. You know, it would go nowhere.
Right? It's kind of like the Mr. Miyagi wax on, wax off. I just dated myself. Uh-huh. So it's idea that you want to create that muscle memory. So you can't tell a student to behave a certain way if they don't have that muscle memory. You can't expect a student to get on stage, project to the back of the room, and make sure that their words touch people if they don't have that muscle memory. Mm-hmm. So just like you wouldn't send an athlete out without strategy, practice, and opportunities to create that muscle memory. I just can't imagine like a football game where it's like, here's the football and it's game day, rather than every day you're making sure that you're creating that musculature. And for us, SEL is the way, it's almost like that training that you need to have the muscle memory so that you can have an educated conversation. You can do research without thinking, oh my gosh, where am I going to start? You understand how to ask questions and questions of your questions and kind of remain curious and how to have that sustained inquiry because you have that muscle memory. So I really want to put those two concepts together because SEL is not just for PBL, it's for life, right? And just because you are in a classroom, the performance that you have in the classroom needs to go in the outside world and vice versa. If you're just doing a performance, like one speech class, like in our book, we talk about oracy, right? Really understanding how to use your voice to, again, touch people, move the world. But we don't have oracy as one of our practices, at least in the United States. We have reading and writing, reading and writing, reading and writing in the communication arts, right? But we don't care really what the students sound like when they speak. And then we wonder why they sound like Neanderthals when you're talking to your high schooler. How was your day? Ugh. Does that make sense? So if I want to take that, if I want to take that practice of how the students expresses themselves, I have to give them that practice in my PBL classroom. PBL just happens to be a place where there's lots of elasticity to do that. But I hope that other teachers that are not doing PBL can pick up this book or pick up our ideas and go, okay, maybe my students don't need what they have, but I have other things that I can teach my students that specifically would help them practice. And every year, students become more and more mature, mm-hmm. muscle memory.
So, one of the things that I'm hearing is the overlap of PBL and SEL means, the students will develop those key SEL skills because PBL becomes the context, the place to practice it, the place where it's going to be most authentic. But there is this other side where great SEL leads to better PBL too, right? So I'm wondering if you could speak to the value of that side of it, where how does someone, because a number of people who listen to this podcast are already pretty steeped in project-based learning, where does the inclusion and the embrace and that overlap of SEL lead to better PBL?
Well, I always think of how we start any PBL workshop, and a lot of people have already probably experienced this, where you look at the portrait of a graduate and you list out the skills you want of your student when they graduate, whether it's from kindergarten, eighth grade, or high school. Mm-hmm. And these list of skills, when we stop and look at them, most of them aren't pure academic, and they're the SEL competencies. And so to me, SEL is the why we do PBL. Like, yeah, I want them to learn my content, but I'm really trying to develop good humans. And so the SEL is the why behind the PBL. And so what happens if you do a project without SEL, which is almost kind of hard to do in some ways, you're if you're doing PBL, you're already teaching some SEL, whether you know it or not. Mm-hmm. But being intentional about it, you are developing, the projects are going to go deeper, like we've already mm-hmm. talked about. They're going to research and find more things. They're going to become more empathetic. You're going to raise a bunch of kids who want to make a difference in the world. And to me, that's what I want to do as an educator. And they're going to be better parents. They're going to be better spouses. They're just going to be better people. And that takes your PBL to the next level, because they're going to be better public speakers. They're going to mm-hmm. be better working at their groups. And so they're going to be more successful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they're going to also be like, you know, we always equate the academic content with the test, because we can't forget the test. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's going to be listeners going, yeah, but how do I have to cover the content in order for my students to do well in that test? But here's a notion that is very counterintuitive. Just because you covered it doesn't mean the student understood it or you know, knows what you said, because you can see that the kids that fail, that you covered it maybe 18 times and they still do not understand it. So it's very important for us not to just think, okay, this is going to help in their future. But the crazy thing about teaching students these five skills, these five competencies, they become more sure of themselves as learners. And because they're more sure of themselves as learners, they're more interested in their learning. And because their learning is more interesting, they're just better test takers. And it's the, mm-hmm. you know, sometimes we're looking right instead of looking left. And mm-hmm. I hope that, you know, teachers worried, especially in elementary, when you have these pacing guides and you really understand how bad, how counterintuitive that science is to pace the kids in a certain way rather than to pique the interest and make them better people.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah. So, you know, if I'm thinking about this, if people are hearing this and they're thinking, oh, all right, these are some great ideas. I can see the why of SEL and the why of PBL. One of the things I want to be real clear about is your book is packed full of practical strategies that people can use. And they're not necessarily, you know, recipe, you have to do this, have to do that. But they are protocols, they're frameworks, they're strategies that are doable, usable. You can absolutely use them. You use the term elevas to describe what these are and how they work. So I'm wondering if you could speak to what is meant by that term. And then maybe if you have a favorite one or one that you would like to share with the audience to kind of let them know what these elevas are that are inside of the book.
So the concept of the eleva, spelled I-L-E-V-A, is a notion from my people. I'm from West Africa and I belong to the Indue people. The Indue people are also nicknamed the beach people. So we are islanders, we are coastal people. And one of the traditions that we have is, you know, when you have a, you know, some life transitions, when you're struggling with life, when you're stuck, you know, traditionally we just go to the elders, and the elders, we'd sit by the feet of the elders, and the elders would impart their wisdom, often hook you up with a network of people. It's almost like, you know, old school internet, right? Mm-hmm. You would find a lot of information that you needed because you were transitioning to a different life, or maybe you were getting married, or just simply you did not know whether, you know, like you're in a fork in the road in life, right? And so in my language, which is the Kombe people, the language is Indue, and we say Ileva. Ileva. And so Ileva becomes the advice. And it's just one of those things. Advice is free. You take it or you can leave it. Just like when you talk to somebody or a guru or somebody that you, a mentor, that advice is there timely, but you can take it or you can leave it. So it's some advice, tried and true, but not necessarily a recipe, like you called it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's kind of fun to listen to put a one of my African words or my Indue words into an American textbook. I just thought it was, I just tickled by that. And also that inspired the cover of the book, which is a very West African traditional starburst fabric. So when you see the book, you'll recognize, and any African in the history of every African is going to look at that front cover and go, why is that fabric on that book?
I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. Do you, and again, sorry for my mispronunciation, if I'm saying
Ileva. It's Ileva. Right. We just say Ileva because, like, for example, in my language, my name is not Matinga, it's Matinga. But, you know, you just can't be correcting people. So Ileva is how we're using it for the book. And we're hoping that, you know, people just kind of use that word.
I love it. I love it.
Yeah.
Do either of you have a favorite one or one that you would want to share from the book?
Mike, which one's your favorite?
Share the care gap, Matinga.
Oh, excellent. So the care gap is my favorite one, right? And the care gap is what we use for when students are stuck. So say, for example, you have a group of students. And by the way, some of these Ilevas are meant for you to just kind of teach whole group and just have these exercises with your whole group. And some mm-hmm. of them, but they're like scaffolds that eventually you put on a shelf, whether it's imaginary, not imaginary, like digital or physical, where the student then can go and get that particular tool to solve the issue that they're having at this time. So my mm-hmm. very favorite one is the care gap. The care gap is a way to just kind of get the students stuck. And I'm just going to kind of pull it up real quick so that I can make sure I get the acronym right. So CARE stands for knowledge, like knowledge gap, authenticity gap, resource gap, effort gap. So say, for example, you have three students in the back of the room, they're goofing around and you keep passing past their table, hoping that they'll notice that they're supposed to be working, but they're not. So then you can sit down with them the first time and go, like, let's do a care gap. And the care gap has a bunch of questions that you can ask the students, such as describe, if it's a knowledge gap, for example, maybe the student has to describe what the project is about. Can you tell me what this project is about? Maybe that could be simple. They just don't know what the project is about. Authenticity gap refers to, you know, is this purposeful for the student? Or is this something that I thought maybe the student needed, but the student does not understand the purpose? A resource gap, do they know where to look? Do they understand the information that I have just shared to them? Or an effort gap? A student might be like, you know what, I got a lot of things going on, or whatever it is that is preventing them from doing that. Then in the bottom of the page, we put together a number of solutions, or at least some suggestions. So if you cannot describe the project, here are some solutions that you can, some suggestions, here's some things that you can do. Soon, you then teach the students how to do that on their own, and we have a student version. So again, the kids are goofing off. Why are you guys goofing off? I don't know. Great. Why don't you do a care gap, right? Just to understand where you're stuck and what is making you so distracted that you are goofing off. Does that make sense?
Yeah. One of the things I loved about that one when I read it was I feel like there's two kind of opposite things that you hear teachers say. One is, you know, we need to be empathetic towards students. We need to remember where they're coming from. We need to be trauma-informed, all these different things. But sometimes you'll only hear that, and then there's like an excuse to just not get your work done, you know? And then you hear this like students, you know, we need to have high expectations for students and expect them to get their work done. And they're totally capable and raise expectations. What I loved about that care gap was it's both, right? It's developing empathy with students, really deeper understanding where they're coming from, but it's solutions focused and still saying, I have high expectations for you. I want to see you be successful.
For sure. You know, and Yeah, and this is the almost like the through line for these ilevas and the idea of the ileva, right? As your mentor, your Sherpa, I'm going to, you know, just kind of give you an opportunity for you to understand who you are, right? And how you roll. And then I'm going to teach you how to manage how you roll. Because when I teach you how to manage how you roll, I can then expect more from you so that when a student comes into class and they're, you know, not focused, they didn't get their work done, they're making excuses. Well, everybody in their class, because we have defined these things and we have put a solution, we've talked about, you know, how do we go about solving it when not, you know, we're having a bad day. What do we do that day? Everybody in the classroom can see what that student is doing and how that student is taking like class time. So instead we want to do this positive peer pressure. And also you can be that warm demander, right? I can demand more from you because I've taught you how to do better, as opposed to an expectation that you understand what effort means, or you understand what I mean by hard work. You can't know everybody's values. That's only a normative value, not necessarily everybody else's values. So something like that. That's my favorite one, the care ileva. How about you, yeah, Mike?
Yeah, and I just want to add in, the care gap is really helpful for me because I sometimes find myself falling into deficit thinking. And it's my assumption too often that students are being lazy and it's an effort issue. And the care gap makes me stop and step back and say, let's look at this from an asset-based lens. Maybe this kid is screwing around because they're hiding the fact that they don't have the skill to do this. Mm-hmm. And it's really the knowledge gap. And so it keeps me to look at students from an asset-based lens, which is what true equity is, instead of just assuming that the student is lazy and doesn't want to do what they're being asked to do. But there could be some reasons, and their behavior is a signal to me that they're trying to hide maybe the fact that they don't know what they're doing because they don't want to be embarrassed. And so it right. really makes me as a teacher look at it through an asset-based lens.
For sure. And project-based learning allows the student to be like, you know what? You don't have to have that skill. We have a team member that can, you know, get up in front of the audience and speak. You don't have to necessarily be a public speaker.
Yeah.
Right? We don't have that idea that everybody in the group has to do exactly the same thing. No, the team turns in the deliverables and you can demonstrate your learning in other ways.
Love it. So final question would be, your book is titled The Pulse of PBL. Mm-hmm. And I am wondering if just briefly, one of you would be willing to share, what is the notion of the pulse of PBL?
Well, we started with this analogy of just the heartbeat, and the heartbeat, the pulse is the lifeblood of your body. And without a heartbeat, you're dead, literally. And so when it comes to PBL, it can be literal, I guess. If you do a project without any SEL in it, it can flop, and it can really be a project that has no emotion to it, no meaning. And it becomes what I call schooly, just another teacher assignment, a research paper in disguise sometimes. And when you're doing SEL, it is that lifeblood that gives meaning to everything in the project. And so that's why we see it as the pulse, because it is what gives the project purpose and meaning and life to the student.
We talked about the weak pulse. Sometimes you have a project well designed and it's got all these really cool things that kids are going to do, but it's not happening. It's a weak project because it's got a weak pulse. And then sometimes the project may not necessarily be super well planned, but the students are suddenly really engaged and really focused and just in a zone because that project has a really strong pulse. And I feel that the stronger the pulse, or the more SEL you train your students in, the stronger the pulse, and the more you don't have to worry about the design because the students are hungry. They're going for, you know, they know how to showcase what they learn and how to prove it to you, which is most important.
I love it. Well, thank you both so much for being on this podcast and for chatting for a while. Again, the book is The Pulse of PBL, and both of you are also available for workshops on this topic. You do a lot of professional development. You do a lot of work with educators. You have the experiential knowledge, the research knowledge, the practical knowledge. And so I just also want to add that if anybody is thinking about doing any kind of professional development on this topic of SEL or PBL, Mike and Matinga are both really great at facilitating authentic, meaningful workshops as well.
Sure. Thank you so much for having us. Really, this has been a really interesting conversation. And just I just hope that our words are resonating. Part of the teaching the students oracy is to ensure that, you know, the arc of their thinking is pushed around in the world so that they can touch something or just kind of, again, have that ripple effect in their life. So I hope that this conversation is, set a spark somewhere, or at least started a conversation.
All right. Well, thank you both.
Thanks so much, John. Appreciate you spending time to chat with us. It's fun.
Yeah, it's been great. All right, so there you have it. That was Mike Cackley and Matinga Rugatz. They are the co-authors of the brand new book, Pulse of PBL. I hope you got as much out of that conversation as I did, because I feel like even just in that conversation, I learned so much, and I have learned so much from being a part of their book process. Would you do me a favor? If you enjoy this podcast, would you leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or wherever it is that you get your podcast? Again, thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day and go out and make something awesome.